Okay, start with something from right away in the beginning of the Sedra. If you look at the order of the Tzivuye HaMishkan in Parshas Truma, HaKadosh Baruch Hu first seemingly commanded Moshe Rabbeinu concerning the Kelim of the Mishkan, and only after it describes how to make the Aron, the menorah, the shulchan, then the Torah describes how to make the infrastructure of the Mishkan itself, the krashim, and the actual building of the structure of the Mishkan. In this week's Sedra, it's just the opposite. First comes the structure of the Mishkan, and then comes, in towards the end of the Sedra, the middle of the Sedra, the various vessels. So the Gemara in Brachos says the following. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu to build a Mishkan and then to build the Kelim, Moshe Rabbeinu turned it around. And he told Bezalel to build the Kelim and then build the Mishkan. And Bezalel said, Lo kach min hago shel olam. That's not the way the world functions. If I make the Kelim first and then the Mishkan, where am I going to put the Kelim till I build the Mishkan? First the person builds his house, then he brings the furniture in. Doesn't bring the furniture and build the house around the furniture. So Moshe said, you're right. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu told me. First the Mishkan, then the Kelim. Betzel kel hayisa v'yodata. You were in the shadow of God and knew. Very, very difficult Gemara. First of all, why in the world did Moshe Rabbeinu change what HaKadosh Baruch Hu told him? If in fact HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu Mishkan and then Kelim, then why did Moshe Rabbeinu change it around and make Kelim and then Mishkan, and Bezalel had a discovery, made a mistake? It's untenable to think that Moshe Rabbeinu made a mistake, because then the whole Torah is in jeopardy. And if he did it on purpose, even more difficult. Why in the world would he try to fool Bezalel? And thirdly, if Bezalel got the right message, then why was he called Bezalel Betzel Kael? Tzel is always a euphemism for doubt, for something that's not clear. Tzilo shel safek, shadow of a doubt. Right, so doubt and shadow go together. On the other hand, Borer Kachama, Borer Kashemesh, it's as clear as the sun. That means something that's for sure. If Bezalel got it right, he shouldn't have been called Bezalel, you were in the shadow of God. It should have been, you were in the light of God. Why is he called the shadow of God? Shadow seems to be the opposite. Doubt. In order to explain this Gemara, I want to explain something else to you, and we'll come back to this eventually. It says that the Aron was inlaid with gold and overlaid with gold. Tocho kebaro. The inside and the outside were gold. And we learn from that that a Talmud Chacham, or for that matter anybody, should be tocho kebaro. Their inside should be like their outside. Okay? They shouldn't be a hypocrite. They shouldn't look one way on the inside and a different way on the outside. They should make sure that on the inside and the outside they're the same. From the way that Chazal described the Aron, Tocho Kibaro, which one comes first, the inside or the outside? Think about it. Why the outside? Right. The inside should be like the outside. That means that the outside's there first. And then you should make the inside fit the outside. On the surface, that is difficult to understand, because we know that the main thing in Yiddishkeit is the inside. Your kavana, Rachmana Liba boy. The Rav Shem wants what you think, your heart, your kavana, not just the empty outside actions. So it should have said, the outside should be like the inside. The main thing is the inside. But you should make the outside fit the inside too. But why taka the inside should be like the outside seems to imply that you start with the outside. The outside is the first thing. The answer is that that's the way it works. As the Chinuch says, Hachitzonios ma'orim esapnimius. You can't start with the inside. It's very difficult to get your neshama moving. You need something to move it. So we always start with the outside. You want to be happy on Yontif. So you eat and you drink. That's external happiness. But hopefully it sinks in and it's ma'orer, your internal happiness. All the mitzvahs are like that. You do external things. Hopefully they are ma'orer ideas, emotions, and so on. Motions generate emotions. That's the way we are. We're physical people, and therefore the physical things generate internal emotional things or whatever. I'll give you a marshal, a true story. When I was a rabbi in Miami, I had a woman who was brought up in a frum home, but very light. Here in Israel, they call it dati light. Right? In other words, not too serious about mitzvahs. Shabbos, they didn't answer the phone, they didn't drive, but Hilchas Shabbos, they never heard of. And the kashrus, as long as it had a K somewhere on the label, even the name of the product, it was okay. So that was the way she was brought up. And she got married, and she had a child, and she started to think that she really wants to be more serious about Yiddishkeit, because she has to bring up this child, and she felt a good responsibility. And she came to me, and she said, I really want to upgrade my Shmiras HaMitzvahs. And I told her to take it slow. And first, her first project was kashrus. She upgraded the kashrus of her home and kashered her home pretty much and only used good hashgachas. And that took a while to learn and to get used to. And then about a year later, she started working on Shabbos, and her husband went along with her with this. And they started learning Hilchas Shabbos, and they started keeping Shabbos much more seriously. In any case, for about 2 years she was really upgrading her Shmiras HaMitzvahs, and then I felt that she was ready for the next change in her life, and that was Tznius. In Miami at the time, you were lucky if people got dressed, let alone dressed halachically. Basically it was only the Rabbonim's wives, the Mechanchim's wives that dressed halachically tzanua. Especially married women, most of them didn't cover their hair with whatever heterim they had or didn't have or whatever. And basically the Klei Kodesh were the ones who dressed tzanua, and surely that the married women covered their hair. So I told her, I think you're ready for the next Shlav, to start dressing more halachically proper. She said, Rabbi, I don't feel like a Rebbetzin inside. I don't want to look like a Rebbetzin on the outside because I'm be a hypocrite. As soon as I feel like a Rebbetzin, I will start dressing like one. That was her response. I told her, you know what you can be compared to? Person who comes to shul on Simchas Torah, and he says, you know, I'm not really happy. Surely not happy with the Torah. And if I get up and dance, I'm a hypocrite, because people are going to think that I'm happy with the Torah. So I'm going to sit here and contemplate being happy, and as soon as I'm happy, I'm going to get up and dance with the Torah. The guy will sit there till Tisha B'Av. You don't become happy unless you dance. That's not hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is when you want to put on a show and you don't want to ever get to those inner feelings. You just want to put on a show. But if you want to get to those inner feelings by going through the motions, then that's the way you do it. Motions create emotions. You want to be happy, dance. That will generate your happiness. So therefore, everything starts with the outside. If you dress modestly, you'll begin to feel modest. But if you continue dressing immodestly, you're never going to feel modest. So that's not a hypocrite. A person who wants to reach the inner feeling, but they have to go through the motions to do it, that's the way to do it. That's perfectly okay. That's not hypocritical. In any case, so that is why Chazal described the Aron as Tocho Kibaro. The inside should be like the outside. Halavai, first you have the outside, and then hopefully the inside will mold itself after the actions of the outside. Very nice. There's only one problem. The Torah doesn't say that. That's how the rabbis describe the Aron. How does the Torah tell us to make the Aron? V'tzipisa oso zahav tahar. You should overlay it or cover it with gold. How? Mibayis umichutz titzapenu. From the inside and the outside. Which is the Torah mentioned first? The inside. So it's very nice that Chazal said that the inside should be like the outside, implying that the outside comes first. But the Torah doesn't say that. The Torah says that the inside comes first and then the outside. So where did Chazal get this idea that you start with the outside when the Torah said you start with the inside? So I think that the answer is that if you look at the pasuk properly, it really refers to three stages. Three stages. If it would just have said v'tzipisa oso zahav tahar, what would that mean? To cover it on the inside or the outside? All the other kelim in the Mishkan where it says to cover it with gold is on the inside or the outside? The outside. So if it just said v'tzipisa oso zahav tahar, it would have meant on the outside. Then it says mibayis, on the inside. And then it says again, bachutz, outside. The Aron was covered three times. First on the outside, just like Chazal say. Then on the inside. And then again on the outside. How did that work? So Rashi says that there were three boxes. They had a little gold box, a medium-sized wooden box, and a larger gold box. First, they put the wooden box inside the gold box. So now it was covered on the outside. So the outside came first. Then they put the little gold box inside the wooden box. Now it was covered on the inside. But what was still left to cover? The rim. If you look down, you saw a sandwich of gold, wood, and gold. So that wood also had to be covered. And then they covered the rim on the outside. So the Aron was covered first on the outside, just like Chazal say, and then on the inside, and then again on the outside. Now what's the symbolism of that? I understand the outside comes first. Hopefully the outside brings you to the inside. What's the next outside? So there is a second function to the externals. Let's go back to the guy on Simchas Torah. Person gets up to dance because he wants to feel happy with the Torah. So he's dancing, and finally his external dancing influences his emotions, and now he feels happy with the Torah. Should he stop dancing now or continue dancing? Is there any purpose now to continue dancing, since the whole purpose of the dancing was to get him happy? Now he's happy, so why dance? Stop. You're happy. Now just sit and bask in your happiness. But there's still an idea to continue dancing. Why? The Ramban... This doesn't sound like the Ramban. In fact, it sounds like a very Hasidish avort. And the Sfas Emes quotes this Ramban many times. The Ramban is in his Perush on Aseres HaDibros, not in his Perush on Chumash, but in a separate kuntras that he wrote, a separate Perush to the Aseres HaDibros. Tell you the truth, I was never able to find this. But if you can find it, I'd appreciate it if you let me know where it is. But the Sfas Emes says it's there, I believe him. The Ramban says the following. He explains a pasuk in Shir HaShirim. Mato'iru umato'oruru es ha'ahava ad shetechpots. Simple meaning of the pasuk: don't arouse God's love until he wants, until the time comes that is proper. It really is an allusion to not trying to force Mashiach to come. Wait till the proper time. Says the Ramban, what does the pasuk mean? If a person has strong emotional feelings of love or fear of God, he should not leave it floating in the air ethereally, but ad shetechpatz, put it into some kind of chefetz, put it into something concrete. emotions are strongest when they are expressed in a physical way. In other words, there is an idea of arousing your emotions, your neshama, by going through the physical, external motions. Once you do that, now you have these tremendous inner feelings. Don't leave them just inner feelings. Now express them in a physical way, because expressing emotions in a physical way is stronger than expressing them without that physical framework. Along those lines, Rav Moshe Cordoviero, the Mekubal, says that the neshamas in Gan Eden look forward to Tchias HaNesim as much as we look forward to Mashiach. Because it's a higher level to be a neshama in a body, where the body can express what the neshama feels physically, more than not being able to express it physically and just having it spiritually. You would think just the opposite, but that's what he says. Which explains a very difficult Ramban, a different Ramban. The Ramban says that Olam Haba is not a spiritual world, but Olam Haba and Tchias HaMesim are the same. Different than the Rambam. Now's not the time to go into what the other opinion is, but the Ramban says that Olam Haba is a physical world and spiritual world, but an eternal physical world. They ask on the Ramban, how can Olam Haba be Tchias HaMesim, where the neshama goes back into a body, when Chazal say that in Olam Haba there's no eating, no drinking? So it's mashma that it's not a physical world, it's a spiritual world. Says the Ramban, of course there's no eating and drinking. Moshe Rabbeinu went up to Har Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights, he didn't eat and drink. Eliyahu HaNavi went through the Midbar for 40 days and 40 nights, didn't eat and didn't drink. A person can reach a level where he's still in his body and he doesn't have to eat and drink. So it's a physical world, but an eternal physical world where the body doesn't need to eat and drink. So they ask on this Ramban, very nice. But if you're not going to have any of the physical attributes of the body, all the physical needs of the body aren't there, then what do you need a body for? Then why is there going to be a body? Why doesn't a person just stay in Gan Eden as a neshama? Why does he have to come back into this world, Tchias HaMesim, if the body's not going to be functional anyway? The answer is, you need a body for two things. In this world, the body creates the infrastructure where the neshama can function in a physical world. Without a body, a neshama can't function in a physical world. So therefore, you need a body to eat and drink. It's like a candle. The flame has no place to take effect unless you have a wick, right, and a fuel source. So you need the physical body to be able to give the neshama the ability to function. We compared it, I think, once to a space, to an astronaut. When he goes into outer space, he can't function unless he wears a special suit, because the conditions in outer space are not favorable to a body to function. Same thing, a neshama can't function in a physical world without a physical body. So it needs eyes to see and ears to hear, and it needs a body that eats and drinks to be able to maintain the neshama, like the wick maintains the flame in a candle. In Olam Haba, the function of the body will not be to create a place where the neshama can exist. In Olam Haba, the neshama will be the main thing, and the neshama will keep the body going. The neshama will nurture the body. So what do you need a body for? Because the neshama needs something to express itself physically, because that's the highest level. So the neshama will use the body to express its emotions, its ideas. But it won't need the body to be able to provide it with an infrastructure. There, the purpose of the physical will be the second purpose, the expression of the spiritual. So again, the physical arouses the spiritual, and then it gives it a place to express itself. Two ends. Therefore, first you work on the outside, then you get to the inside, and then you work on the outside again. You create the spiritual through the physical, and you express the spiritual again through the physical. Okay? Now, when Moshe Rabbeinu was told about the Mishkan, he was told about it before the sin of the golden calf. On Har Sinai, the Ribbono Shel Olam knew there was going to be a Chet HaEgel, because he knows everything. But his knowledge doesn't interfere with people's free choice. How that works, it's a miracle. For whatever way, God functions as if he doesn't know. But he knows. But his knowledge doesn't affect free choice. But human knowledge does affect free choice. If people would know what's going to be, then it would have to happen, or they wouldn't know. Therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam could not tell Moshe Rabbeinu that there's going to be a sin of the golden calf, even though he knew there was going to be one. There was a fundamental difference between the purpose of the Mishkan before the sin of the golden calf, had there not been a sin of the golden calf, and after the Chet HaEgel. And that's the following. Before the Chet HaEgel, you did not need a Mikdash to create a physical place that you could be aroused to God's presence. You didn't need that. Because it says, Bechol ha-makom asher askir ha-shemi, avoy lecho ve-rachticha. Wherever I'll mention my name, you'll be able to come and feel my presence. You don't need a mikdash. You don't need a physical plant. Anywhere in the world, a person could have felt HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence. After the Chet HaEgel was not the case. After the Chet HaEgel, you needed a mikdash to arouse you to feel God's presence. So there would have been a Mishkan before the Chet HaEgel, but its purpose would have been different than after the Chet HaEgel. Before the Chet HaEgel, you wouldn't have needed the mikdash to arouse you to feel God's presence. You could have that anywhere. So what did you need the mikdash for? Once you were aroused anywhere in the world to feel God's presence, and you wanted to express that closeness, then you came to the mikdash and made use of the kalim of the mikdash to express those feelings that you got anywhere in the world. So the main purpose of the mikdash was to use the physical kalim to express the emotions that you got anywhere in the world. And then that even elevated those emotions even more. But the first thing was the kalim, the utensils, not the infrastructure of the mikdash. That wasn't the main thing. You didn't need that infrastructure to get you to a level. You got to the level anywhere. Then you used the kalim, and that elevated everything. So before the Chet HaEgel, it was true. First came the kalim, and then the mikdash. But God knew there was going to be a Chet HaEgel. So he really told Moshe, after the Chet HaEgel, you needed to come to the mikdash first, feel God's presence, and then express that through the kalim. But first you needed to come to the mikdash to feel God's presence. So therefore, when God gave the command to Moshe Rabbeinu, had he told him clearly, build a mikdash and then the kalim, Moshe would have said, why? Why is the mikdash first? Why do we need a mikdash to arouse us to God's presence? We can feel that anywhere. And God would have had to tell him, but there's going to be a sin of the golden calf. And that couldn't be. Moshe couldn't have had even a hint that there was going to be a chet and their level would change. So God, on purpose, clouded his command to Moshe and made him think that the mikdash came, that the kalim became before the Mishkan. It wasn't like that. It really was first Mishkan and then kalim. But he made Moshe Rabbeinu think the other way, so he shouldn't have a hint that there's going to be a chet HaEgel. When Moshe told Bezalel, Bezalel said, that can't be. Lokach min hago shalom. That was after the Chet HaEgel. Now, I can't make the kalim, because without the mikdash, the kalim are useless. We need something first to arouse us to God's presence, and then to be able to express it through the kalim. So when God told you, he must have meant mikdash first and then kalim, but he clouded it from you. He hid it from you, that you shouldn't know there's going to be a Chet HaEgel. That's exactly what Moshe said. You knew the shadow that God put over me. God put me into a situation where it sounded one way, but it really was a different way. He didn't want me to see it clearly. And you understood the shadow of God, The fact that he made it unclear, and now it became clear why it was unclear then, because he didn't want me to know that there was going to be a Chet HaEgel. So that is the order of the Mishkan. God originally told Moshe Rabbeinu in a way that appeared to be Kalim and then Mishkan in order to keep Moshe Rabbeinu from knowing there's going to be a Chet HaEgel. But in fact, what he said was Mishkan and Kalim knowing that there's going to be a Chet HaEgel and that's going to have to be the order. And that's what Bezalel understood. Okay. And so one more point. According to this idea, you can understand something else that the Meshech Chochma points out in a little bit different way, but according to what I just explained to you now, it makes a lot of sense. If you look in last week's Sedra, in Kisisa, or this week's Sedra, let's start with this week's Sedra. This week's Sedra, the Torah starts with speaking about Shabbos, and then about the Mishkan. So the rabbis learn from that Shabbos supersedes the Mishkan. Shabbos comes first. And you don't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. Okay? But in last week's Sedra, the Torah spoke about the Mishkan, and then in the end, it spoke about Shabbos. That would seem to imply that if we only had last week's Sedra, not this week's Sedra, what would supersede what? The Mishkan would supersede Shabbos. And you'd build the Mishkan on Shabbos. Because in last week's Sedra, first comes the Mishkan, then Shabbos. If in this week's Sedra, because Shabbos comes before the Mishkan, we learn from that Shabbos supersedes the Mishkan, then in last week's Sedra, we should have learned that the Mishkan supersedes Shabbos. Which is it? According to what I said, it's very simple. Last week's Sedra was still before the sin of the golden calf. Had there not been a sin of the golden calf, you could have built the Mishkan on Shabbos. In 1 second, I'll explain why. It's only after the Chet HaEgel that you couldn't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. Why? The Meshech Chochma points out that there are things in the Mishkan that are Docha Shabbos. Karbonos. You bring Karbonos on Shabbos. You make the fire on the Mizbeach on Shabbos. Cooking, fire. So many things that you do in the Beis HaMikdash are done on Shabbos, and they're Chil Shabbos normally. They're Mutter. Shabbos is pushed away from the Avodah. So why isn't building the Mishkan push away Shabbos? Says, I think the Meshech Chochma says, if he doesn't, then the idea is the following. You know why Shabbos supersedes the Mishkan? You don't build the Mishkan on Shabbos? Because, just like you don't wear tefillin on Shabbos. Because tefillin is an os that God has a connection with us. But Shabbos is an os. If I wear tefillin on Shabbos, I'm saying that the Shabbos isn't enough. You need something else. Shabbos shows me that God's presence is amongst us. Shabbos brings God's presence to Klal Yisrael. So anything else that would intimate that I need something else to bring God's presence contradicts Shabbos. It's in conflict with Shabbos. So therefore, the Shabbos pushes it away. But serving the Shekhinah, not bringing the Shekhinah, but serving it, that doesn't contradict the Shabbos. So you can serve the Shekhinah on Shabbos even if it means Chilul Shabbos, even if it means doing things you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. The Torah says that's okay, because that's not a conflict with Shabbos. Serving the Shekhinah on Shabbos is fine. But creating Shekhinah on Shabbos is a conflict with Shabbos. Shabbos creates that Shekhinah. Why do you need something else? So, before the Chet HaEgel, the purpose of the Mishkan was not to create Shekhinah. It was to serve Shekhinah with the Kalim. And therefore, building the Mishkan didn't conflict with Shabbos. You could build it on Shabbos. But after the Chet HaEgel, the purpose of the Mishkan was twofold. One, to first create Shekhinah and then serve it. Creating Shekhinah on Shabbos you can't do, because Shabbos does that. You don't need a Mishkan. Shabbos will do it. Shabbos is a Mikdash too. So if you have another Mikdash, build another Mikdash on Shabbos, it conflicts with Shabbos. So have the Mikdash of Shabbos, you don't need the other Mikdash. Once it's there, it's there. But to build it on Shabbos would conflict with Shabbos. That's only after the Chet HaEgel, where the function of the Mikdash was both to create a feeling of Shekhinah and to serve it. But before the Chet HaEgel, The purpose of the Mikdash was only to serve the Shechina. The Kalim were the Iker. Therefore, there was no conflict with Shabbos. You could build it on Shabbos too. Okay. Any questions on this? Now I want to go to something else. First, something short. Let's go another thing to this Tocho Kedbarim. The Aron was gold on the outside, gold on the inside, and wood in the middle. What's the symbolism? A Talmud Chacham should be inside and outside gold. Ask the Das Zakenim Bali Atosis the following question. Wouldn't it have been more symbolic if the Aron was solid gold? Why was it wood on the inside and gold on the outside? Make it solid gold. And that's even better. A Talmud Chacham should be solid gold, not just gold on the inside, gold on the outside. So some say that the answer to that question is that gold is a lifeless thing. Torah is a living thing. So you need wood. Wood is a tzchayim hi. So that represents the Torah. And the gold represents the finishing. But gold doesn't represent Torah, so you have to have the wood, and then that's a Talmud Chacham, and the Talmud Chacham has to be gold on the outside and gold on the inside. It's one answer. Others say that gold is very, very valuable, but it's also malleable. You can, it's flexible. As opposed to wood, wood is rigid. A Talmud Chacham has to be gold on the outside and gold on the inside, but with all that gold, he has to be able to be flexible. But in his core, he can't be flexible. The core has to be rigid. But on the outside, how he deals with people, and on the inside, what he thinks about himself, there he can be flexible. But his core has to be, what's it called, rigid. That Reb Shamshon Falhurst says. Now I'll tell you what the Das Zakenim says. He says something very practical. He says, yeah, it would have been much more symbolic had the Aron been gold on the inside, had been solid gold, and not just gold on the inside and outside of wood. But if it had been made of solid gold and not predominantly wood, with a thin covering of gold on the inside and the outside, it would have been too heavy to carry. A gold box, solid gold box with those dimensions would have been impossible for a human being to carry. The Aron didn't have to be carried, because the Aron miraculously carried the people who carried it, but ain't some chimalanes. It had to be able to be carried naturally, not only miraculously. You can't rely on miracles. So they had to build an Aron. The Rabban Shem told them to build an Aron that was possible to carry humanly and wasn't too heavy for a human being to carry, or even a lot of human beings to carry. Okay. That is the Das Zakenim, yeah? Yeah, that's what we just said. But you can't rely. That's a miracle. You don't rely on miracles. It had to be able to be carried naturally too. Okay, hold on 1 second. It's a nice Das Zakenim in Bali Atos. It's very practical. Let me tell you what I learned from that with the following story. I had a girl in my kehila, a Balas Tshuva, and she must have been about 15, 16 years old. And as many Baalei Tshuva are, she was really gung-ho about Yiddishkeit more than you could imagine, more than anybody could imagine, more than the Rabbanu Shlom could even imagine. Her mother was a woman who knew nothing about Yiddishkeit. Zero. The girl had become influenced, I think, by NCSY, and she became from. And the mother was a tzaddikus. She wasn't frum, but she was a tzaddikus. This woman went along with anything her daughter wanted. She was a mother alone. I don't know if the father had died or the father wasn't in the picture when I got to know them. And I had no idea, I never knew of the father. I don't know if she was a widow or a divorcee, but she was a single mother raising this one daughter. And the daughter became frum. The mother knew nothing, zero about Yiddishkeit. But she helped her daughter with everything. Daughter came home and said, I need new clothing. She bought her a whole new wardrobe of clothing. Daughter came home and said, the house has to be kosher. They koshered the house. Shabbos, I don't want you to watch TV. She didn't watch TV. Whatever the daughter wanted, the mother went along and saw that it was a nice thing she was doing. She herself, not for me, but she helped her daughter out. Very nice woman. But every few days, she'd find out something new that the daughter would come home with. And sometimes she couldn't believe that this is really Judaism, this is what you really have to do. And sometimes it wasn't, right? The girl, you know, misunderstood or whatever. So the mother would come to me to ask me, Rabbi, my daughter came home the other day with another surprise, right? Is this really necessary or whatever? So once the mother comes to me and she says to me, Rabbi, aren't you an Orthodox rabbi? I said, yeah. She said, then why don't you keep kosher? I said, knew something was coming. So I said, okay, let's hear what your daughter told you now. At that time in Miami, there was a Glatt kosher butcher shop, which all the rabbis gave a hechsher to. The rabbinical council gave a hechsher, which is perfectly fine. The only problem was the meat was brought in from Denver, and it was 100% okay, glatt, whatever, except it didn't have chassidish shechita. What's chassidish shechita? That certain things that are not necessarily have anything to do with kasherus, but kepedis that some people have. For instance, the shochet has to have a beard. Nowhere in Shulchan Aruch do you find that a shochet has to have a beard, right? If he shaves his beard in a permissible way, it's 100% okay. But by chassidim, they want the shochet to have a beard. So they don't accept shochetim without a beard, and it's not chassidish shechita without that. And maybe some other inyan. So there was a small group of people in Miami, mostly Lubavitchers and some other chassidim also, who got together, and they said, even though they were the rabbis who gave the hashgacha to this butcher shop, but for themselves they wanted something that was not necessarily more kosher, but the hidurim that they were makbid on. So they would bring in meat with chassidish shechita. There was no homegrown animals in Miami. There wasn't enough grazing area in Florida. So they didn't have schlachthäusern in Florida. It was all out from outside. So they would bring in chassidish shechita for a very small group of people who wanted it. Now, since it was a small group, right, they couldn't do it on a regular basis. So they brought it in like four times a year, and you had to buy a four quarters of an animal in order to be part of this group at a time. So you had to get a special freezer to keep your meat in, because it took up a whole freezer. And the meat cost about double what the normal glatt kosher meat cost, because they're bringing it for a small amount of people and had to go with a lot of expense. So, and you also had to travel about 50, 60 miles round trip to pick it up at one central place where they trabered it or whatever in a slaughterhouse that existed, a non-kosher slaughterhouse that existed somewhere in the middle of Florida. Okay. So it cost double. It involved a tremendous amount of bother to get it, and you had to buy a freezer special just for this meat. She said, my daughter came home, and she said, we no longer can buy from the Glatt Kosher Butcher Shop where you give the Hashgacha and all the other rabbis, and where you buy your meat, because it's not kosher. We have to buy meat that I have to travel 60 miles round trip, pay double the price, and I have to buy a freezer, because that's the only kosher meat. So I said, let me take care of this. So I called the daughter in, and I told her this Das Akenemi Baliatosfas. I said, you know, the Aron would have been great if it was solid gold, but it would have been too heavy for the people to carry it. I said, you know, sometimes it's great to be solid gold and to want to be machmir and be mahader and have that really top-rate chassidish shechita meat. So when you get married and you have to make the trip and you have to pay the money, right, and you have to buy the freezer, then kol hakavod. But right now your mother has to make the trip and your mother has to pay the money and your mother has to buy the freezer because you want to be solid gold. Don't be too heavy for your mother to carry. You want to do what's right. Your mother's willing to go along with everything. Right? What's necessary is necessary. What's solid gold, that already you could be a little bit flexible on the solid gold and wait until you are the one who has to carry it and not somebody else has to carry you when you're too heavy for them to carry. That's what I think you can learn from this Das Zakenim Mibali Atosas, very practical, but Lamaisa, there's also, I think, a Musar lesson in it also. And again, it applies to Hidurim. It doesn't apply if the girl would have, the mother would have come and said, my daughter won't turn on the lights on Shabbos, right? And it makes very uncomfortable in the house. Then I would have explained to the mother that this is something she can't be flexible on, and you're going to have to accommodate her. But since this was not something that she couldn't be flexible on, we're not talking about halacha, we're talking about Hidurim being solid gold, then this applies. To be solid gold, it's very nice if you're the one carrying the chumras. If it's somebody else, right, you want to get up and say tikkun chatzos every morning, you know, it's very nice, but don't wake up the rest of the family. So if somebody else has to carry you, then make sure that you're able to be carried and not too heavy for them. Okay. Any questions on that? Go to something else. Next, the Torah, Rashi brings down that the Nesiim lost a yud from their name in this week's Sedra. Hanesiim heviyu. Because when Moshe Rabbeinu announced that people should donate various things to the Mishkan, the Nesiim said, we'll wait and see what everybody else brings, and whatever they don't bring, we will supplement. And in the end, they brought some very expensive stuff. They brought all of the precious gems for the ephod and the choshen. They brought the ktores and besamim for the shemen hamishra and the ktores hasamim, which are extremely expensive things. And they brought the shemen for the menorah and the shemen hamishra. Those three things they brought, because Klal Yisrael brought everything else. So the Nesiim were punished, seemingly because they didn't jump in right away. They waited, and they lost a yud from their name. Few questions. First of all, you know, I wouldn't mind if I had somebody, a supporter of my yeshiva, who said to me, you know what, whatever you can raise, Rabbi, do it. And whatever you can't, I'll make up the deficit. I'll make sure that you don't have a deficit. I'll supplement your budget, whatever you can't do. I don't think I would punish the guy, right? I think I'd be very happy if somebody did that for me. So what did the Nesiim do wrong? They said, we'll wait and see. Whatever's necessary, we'll supplement. And it's not that they didn't bring anything. In the end, they brought three very expensive things, three very expensive materials. So what was the problem? Why were they punished? So on a simple level, I was once thinking, and why Dafka is a yud left out of their name? Why is that the punishment, the yud left out? So I was thinking, if you look in Rashi, there were 13 different, materials that were given to the Mishkan. Okay, you have to understand how to make that work, but the truth is there were 13. 13 different materials. Out of those 13, how many did the Nesiim end up bringing? Three. Stones, oil, and incense. How many didn't they bring? 10. So a yud was left out of their name. Because they didn't come fast, they could have brought a little bit from all 13. They only ended up bringing three. 10 they didn't bring, so the yud is left out of their name. Okay, I have a better answer though. And that's the following. It says, v'yikhu li truma. Kechu me'itam. The word v'yikhu means to take. It should have said v'yitnu li truma, give. Why, when they're giving to the Mishkan, is it called taking? The answer is very simple. Tornis Rufus HaRosha once asked Rabbi Akiva, if God loves poor people so much, why doesn't he support them? Why does he tell us to give them tzedakah? You love the poor people, support them. Why put it on us? So Rabbi Akiva said, of course God can support the poor. It's not for the sake of the poor that he told us to give tzedakah, because it's absurd to think that if you believe that God gives a rich man extra money and commands him to give it to the poor person. Why doesn't he cut out the middleman? Just give it to him directly. So it's not for the sake of the poor person, because for the sake of the poor person, God could give it to him. But it's for the sake of the rich person. God wants us to have a schus. So he commands us, he gives us extra, and he commands us to help out other people, and therefore we have that schus of helping someone else. And that's what it says that Ruth told Naomi. The man I did for today, his name was Boaz. What'd she do for him? She took his money. She took his crops. He let her glean in his field. She did for him, he did for her. No, I did for him. Because Yosher, the Gemara says, Mimashe ha'osher osem ha'oni. More than the osher does for the oni, ha'oni osem ha'osher. The oni does for the osher. The osher only gives the oni money. The oni gives the osher a mitzvah which God can't give him. God can give him money, but God can't give you a mitzvah. So the oni enables you to do a mitzvah, whereas the osher only gives him the oni money, which God can give him. The Chafetz Chaim said this idea legabe supporting Torah. That's why it says the Aron, right, looked like it was being carried by the people who carried it, who represent the supporters of Torah. But the truth is that the Aron carried the people who carried it. It was the Aron that supported the supporters, not the supporters who supported the Aron. And the Chafetz Chaim says that's the meaning of the pasuk Eitz Chaim hi lemachazikim ba. The somchera miushor. Tomeich means to support. Machazik means to hold on for dear life. When you're drowning and you want to hold on to a log, it's called machazik, holding on to it. He says the Torah is an Eitz Chaim for those people who understand that by supporting the Torah, they're supporting themselves. They're holding on to the Torah for dear life, and Torah is really supporting them. It's picking them up. But somchera, the people who think they're supporting the Torah, miushar, they'll be fortunate, but it's not an Eitz Chaim for them. Only for the people who understand that by supporting the Torah, they're supporting themselves. And the Chafetz Chaim was true to that. The Chafetz Chaim, somebody once came to the Chafetz Chaim, I'm waiting for somebody to do this to me and I will fail the test. Hopefully. But the Chafetz Chaim, somebody came to him and said, I want to underwrite the entire budget of your yeshiva. Don't have to go collect, whatever. I want to write, I want the schus of having your yeshiva I'm supporting it. Chafetz Chaim said, I'm sorry, I can't let you do that. He said, something wrong with my money? He said, no. God could support my yeshiva. He could send me money in a million different ways. Why doesn't he? Because he wants to give the schus to Klal Yisrael to have a share in my yeshiva. I can't let you take the whole thing. It has to be shared by other people. You can give me a considerable amount, but you can't have everything. I have to let it open to other people too. Because the Rebbeinu Shem could support me, so he doesn't, because he wants to give the schus. You can't take that schus away from other people. I think the Panavizhe Rav probably would have taken the money and started another yeshiva. Also. But in any case, that was the Chafetz Chaim. There's a maisa, famous maisa that they tell in Tells, as they do with Tells. The original Telzer Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Lazer Gordon, who founded the Telzer Yeshiva in Lita. So when he was a young man, his father-in-law, when he got married, said that I would like to support you. Come and live in my home, eat at my table, you don't have to worry about Parnassa, and for 5 years I want you to be able to devote yourself totally to Torah, because you have the potential to be one of the Gedolim, and Taka was, and I see that if you could devote yourself completely for 5 years without worrying about Parnassa, it'll be to your advantage. So they lived 5 years. At the end of the 5 years, he was offered a Rabbonis that he wanted to take. So he sent his wife to tell her father to ask his bracha that they could leave. So the wife went, and she told her father, my husband was offered a position, and 5 years is up, and the father turned white, and he said, no way. I want you to stay another 5 years. And if it's money, I'll give you more money. Whatever it is, you have to stay. She went back to her husband, and he said, I feel very uncomfortable. Things were very different then. And, your father's been supporting us. We have a few little children. It's difficult. He's a Rav. He's not a rich man. I feel very funny staying here. But if he's made such a big deal about it, and he wants us to be, then he did us a favor for 5 years. We can't go against what he wants. We'll stay another 5 years. I'll give up this position. So after the next 5 years, they had a nice sized family, and it was really difficult to support them. So, and he had a more prestigious offer of a Rabbonis, and he really wanted to take it. So he sent his wife again to get her father's bracha. They should leave. At this time, the mother was there too. So she said, you know, we're getting a big family, and it's difficult for you to support us, and time has come for us to worry about our own parnasa. So my husband wants permission to take this rabbonis, which he really wants, and time for us to leave. And the mother said, you know, she's right. How long can we support them? And the father said, I don't know who's supporting who, but I'm not going to stand in the way of my son-in-law's career. I give my bracha, let them go. And the day they left, the father-in-law died. And then the mother-in-law understood what he meant. I don't know who's supporting who. So Torah supports those people who support it. And to think that the Rabban Shalom needs you to give money is absurd. He can give the money. He gave it to this one, he cut out the middleman. So therefore, what's it called? With that you can understand a few other things. It says that Meiser Sheni, you give 2 years, you go eat your Meiser in Yerushalayim yourself. The third year you give it to the poor people. Shouldn't it be just the opposite? 2 years you give it to the poor, and then if you're a good guy and you gave it to the poor people for 2 years, God said, okay, this year you can go eat it yourself. Eat it in Yerushalayim, enjoy yourself. Not 2 years, eat it in Yerushalayim, enjoy yourself, and then the third year give it to the poor. Why is it the opposite? Now the answer is that I think that the main thing of tzedakah is not that you're giving to the poor person, because God could give them. The main thing is that you give. The Rambam says, if you have a choice of giving one person $1,000 or giving 1,000 people a dollar, even though it's not always that way, right? But you're talking about people who don't really need it that desperately. It's better to give 1,000 people $1 each than one person 1,000. Because, again, the people who are getting it, that's not the main idea. The main idea is what you're giving. So giving 1,000 times has a more of an impression on you than giving one time, even of some more money. The main thing is for the usher, and therefore avas chesed, that you love doing it, makes it more impressive on you. So therefore the Torah said like this, the ani can wait, but I want you to give it to that ani with simcha. So the first 2 years, I'm going to tell you what to do with your money. You can eat it, enjoy it, but you can't do anything else with it, bring it to Yerushalayim. So you understand that it's my money, I can tell you what to do with it. The third year, I'm telling you to give it to the ani, and I want you to enjoy it just as much as if you ate it yourself. That's the idea. And that's why on Purim, there's a mitzvah of matanos levyonim, and we give one thing to a poor person, to two poor people, and by mishloach manos, we give two things to the rich guy. Two things to the rich guy and only one thing to the poor person? And one rich guy but two poor people? That's the idea. Purim, somebody could say, well, God controls the world. That's what Purim tells me. God's in control of the world, so fine, let him take care of the poor people. Comes along the Rabbanan and say, no, we want you. God wants you to be involved. But it's not for the sake of the poor person, it's for your sake. Therefore, give him one thing. Give the rich person two things. Who knows, you know, what's going to be with him? The poor person, I'll take care of. You give him one thing. But give two people, so you give twice, so it makes an impression on you. Now, bottom line. The Nisiyim, the problem wasn't what they gave or what they didn't give. It was their attitude. They said, you know what? We'll make up the deficit. What deficit? It's absurd. God says, look, I want to build a Mishkan. Could you help me? Could you donate some material? God can make the materials. He could create the materials. He gave them the materials. Why does he have to ask them for it? It's obviously not because there's a deficit, because God's missing something. Could you help me with a few materials for the Mishkan? It's to give them a schus. So Nasi who says, I'll wait and see what's missing and we'll make up the deficit. What deficit? The Rebbe Shem wants you to do it for your sake, not for his sake. Therefore, their whole attitude was wrong. And therefore, they lost a yud from their name. Why? Because Nisiyim with a yud means to carry others. But without the yud, you can read it, Nisaim, those who are carried. You think you're carrying? You're being carried. So I'm going to take the yud out of your name and remind you, don't think you're the ones who are carrying, you're the ones who are being carried. It's your schus that carries you. Not that you're carrying the Mishkan or you're carrying Klal Yisrael, because you're doing that, you're the one who ends up getting carried. Don't forget that. So he took the yud out and made it Nisoyim instead of Nisiyim. Okay.
One second.
And this is Rachel,
our cousin. Glad to meet you. Rachel, this is the birthright
trip. Oh, wow.
First time
in Israel.
Yeah.
Okay, it's very special. Okay, you should come back many more times.
It's okay if we both sit in that.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Last week, we started to discuss what simcha, what happiness is. And we basically asked a lot of questions, and we described what happiness is not. It's not what most people think, the thing that you're missing, and if you only had it, you'd be happy. Because things usually can't make you happy, because when you get the thing, you find out there's more things, and whatever you have, you want more, and the more you have, the more you want. So, ha-nefesh lo simole, things usually are not the things that make you happy. And then we ask the question whether life in this world is altogether important. I mean, we have a world to come which is eternal. This world is 120 years compared to eternity is a drop in the bucket. Is it really all that important? And we said that in one Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, it seems to say that this world is really nothing compared to the next world. And yet another Mishnah says that this world is even greater than the next world. So we said it really depends on your philosophy of life. And if your philosophy of life is that life starts when you're born and it ends when you leave this world, and the purpose of life is to amass as many toys in between those two points of pleasure and enjoy yourself, and that's a successful life, then life really, if you think about it, is very dismally depressing. And we explained why. Because basically when you're born, you begin to die. And life is like a fatal disease that you can't survive. Anybody who's born with a disease called life eventually dies from it. So, and we'll see another aspect of that in a second. But we said that that is not our philosophy of life. So now let's talk a little bit about our philosophy of life. Life doesn't start when you're born, and life doesn't end when you leave this world. We believe that a person basically was created as a soul. We are neshamos. We're souls. We are not bodies with little Casper the Friendly Ghost flitting around inside of us called a neshama. We are neshamos who happen to be wearing a body in this world. We were created as souls and existed like that for thousands of years in a spiritual world, able to see without eyes and hear without ears. The soul, which is a spiritual being, can exist very nicely in a spiritual world without a body. But when the soul came into this world, and we'll discuss in a few seconds why it had to come into this world, it needed a space suit to wear, an inner space suit, like an astronaut wears a suit when he goes into outer space. An astronaut on Earth can very much well function without any special apparatus, because the Earth is compatible to a human being. But when he goes into outer space, there is no oxygen, there is no air pressure, there are no sound waves, so he needs an oxygen apparatus to breathe, he needs a pressurized suit, and he needs a radio to speak through, because there are no sound waves, so he has to speak through radio waves. When he comes back to Earth, takes off the suit, and functions again very nicely without it. As long as we were neshamos in a spiritual world, we could function very nicely without a body. But once we came into this physical world, in a physical world, you need eyes to see and ears to hear and arms and legs to get around with. So God gave us a space suit to wear in this physical world, so our souls could function in a physical world. When we leave the world, we leave the spacesuit here, just like the astronaut takes it off when he comes back to Earth. And for that reason, one of the reasons why we express mourning for somebody who died by tearing our clothing. because it represents the fact that it's only the clothing that's been torn away, but the essence of the person still exists. So we were created as souls, then we come into this world as physical beings, and eventually we leave this world and we go on back to that spiritual world eternally. So we are eternal beings who spend a very short time, relatively speaking, in this physical world. So what's the purpose of it? God created us as neshamas. We're going to end up as neshamas. Why don't we just stay like that? What have they come into this world for? So the rabbis told us the following, and this is not an explanation of why God created the world or created human beings. It's explaining something else, which we'll see in a second, because if it's an answer to the question I just phrased, it's absurd, what I'm going to tell you. So let me tell you first, and then I will explain what I'm talking about. What the rabbis tell us is the following. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, being the ultimate good, wanted to shower his goodness on a creation that could receive that ultimate good, which is himself. So God created a creation that is very, very like him, the closest thing to him that exists, our souls, and his intention was to shower his goodness on those souls eternally. And that goodness is himself, meaning that God would bond with that soul eternally, and that is the ultimate spiritual, eternal pleasure that could be. And God, being the ultimate good, wanted to share his goodness with a creation that could receive it. So he created our souls, and he could have bonded with them eternally, and that's what's called the world to come. Olam haba is tzadikim yoshvim va'atroseim b'rosheihem v'nehenem iziv ashchina. Tzadikim bask in God's presence. They bond to God's presence. That is the eternal pleasure that God wanted to shower upon us. So then fine, create our souls, bond with us eternally and finished. What do we need this world for? Why do we have to come into a physical world? So the rabbis tell us, because God knew that it wouldn't be the ultimate good if he gave us that bond unearned. Because a person does not really appreciate 100% what he gets unearned. He's embarrassed. It's like bread that you're given, you're thrown for free, you're embarrassed to eat because you didn't do anything to earn it. What you earn, you appreciate more. And therefore the Rabban Hashem said the following, I'm going to put you in a physical world, distance from me, and I want you to create the bond with me rather than me creating the bond with you. And that way you'll appreciate it eternally to its utmost. There's only one problem with this. Let me stop for a second, and this is all in parentheses now. I want to explain why what I told you, this does not answer why God created the world the way he did. Because if that is the question, then this answer is absurd. Because God could have saved a lot of time and money and not created this world and do something else. He could have changed one rule. Who said that people don't appreciate what they don't earn? Who made that rule? Obviously, God. So all God had to do is change one rule and create souls that appreciate what they don't earn. And then he didn't have to create this world. He'll save a lot of time and a lot of money. Just create souls that appreciate what they don't earn. So why didn't he do that? The answer to that question is, there is no answer. But it's not because there is no answer, it's because we can't possibly understand an answer to that question. Because our minds are limited, and we can only understand what we have a frame of reference to, what's in our realm, and I'll prove it to you. Close your eyes, not too tightly, because I don't want to be the only person awake over here, and picture nothingness, okay? Close your eyes, and in your mind's eye, picture nothingness. You have picture that nothingness? Now take your hand and put it into that nothingness in your mind. Is your hand now in the middle of that nothingness? That's not nothingness. That's space. Try again. Picture nothingness. No space. Don't try. You get a headache. It's impossible. You know why it's impossible? Because we have no frame of reference to no space. We live in a world where there's always space. So anything that we have a frame of reference to within our realm, there's no, doesn't exist, no space. I'll give you another example. Imagine something that you never saw and never heard of. It's impossible. Because if you never saw or heard of it, you have no point of reference to it. You can't even imagine it. What can you imagine? A monster with 10 heads, 6 arms, 4 legs? But legs, arms, and heads you've seen and heard about. You're just combining them together to make something grotesque. But something that you actually never heard or never saw, any part of it, is impossible to imagine. Because you have no point of reference. Even God. God is not in our realm. Yes, He is. God created the world. And the only way we can relate to God is as the creator. That's the name Yudke Vavke, means God. It was Mahaveh. He created the world. God before creation, beyond creation, we have no name for Him. We refer to Him as Ein Sof, infinity, which means I have no idea what I'm talking about. So there's no name. We can't relate to God except within the creation. And therefore, you're not allowed to ask, the Mishnah says, what came before the world, what's beyond the world, not because it's usur, not because it's prohibited, because it's impossible. It's out of our realm. Our minds can't grasp anything we have no point of reference to. And therefore, asking a question, why couldn't have God created the world differently, is a question on God's mind before creation. That's something that we have no connection to. There's no way for us to understand that. So what can we answer? Only the following question. Once God created the world the way we see it, what can we understand about it? That's all. Why He couldn't have created it differently? There's no way that a human being could possibly understand that. That's God's mind. So we're not explaining why God created the world the way He did. And then we have a question, then why couldn't He have done it differently? But for whatever reason, God knew this is the way to do it. I can't understand that. But that's what God understands. But once He did it the way He did, this is what we can understand about it within the system. Once the system exists, this is what we can understand about the system. So therefore, the Ribono Shel Olam created our neshamos. The purpose was that He wanted to bond with us forever. But He wanted us to earn it. But it's more than earning it. We don't earn a share in the world to come. It's not a Purim carnival where you play games, and if you win, you get coupons. At the end of the day, you go to the prize booth and cash in your coupons. You got a lot of coupons, you get a big bear. Little coupons, you get a little bear. So people think that's what Olam Haba is. In this world, there's games to play. They're called mitzvahs. Unfortunately, there are games to play that are called averis. And you get points or you get demerits. And after 120 years, they punch your name into this master computer, and they add up all your points, subtract all your demerits, give you a coupon, tell you to cash it in for a share in the world to come. Doesn't work like that. Because that also would not be the ultimate pleasure. Because earning something is better than getting it for free, but there's something even greater than that. I'll give you an example. Imagine if you wanted one of these very plush recliner chairs, you know, really comfortable reclining chairs. And your birthday was coming up, and you were hoping somebody would give it to you for a present. And your birthday came, and somebody gave it to you as a present, and you sat in the chair. Do you think you'd enjoy it? Yeah, 100%. But what would be if nobody gave you it as a present? And you had to go out and work 6 days a week, 8 hours a day, to earn enough money in a month to buy that chair. And you really wanted the chair, so you got this job, and you worked for a month, and you finally had enough money to buy the chair. You went out and bought the chair. Now you sat in it. Do you think you'd appreciate it more than it had been given to you as a present? 100%. What about the following? You planted trees, nurtured them for years till they grew big enough to cut down for lumber. You cut down your trees, made lumber out of it, mined iron, made nails, knocked the frame of the chair together from your lumber and your nails. Then you raised sheep, sheared their wool, made the stuffing for the chair. You raised cotton, spun it into thread, made the upholstery of the chair, and when you finished making your chair, you sat in it. Do you think you'd appreciate it more even if you bought it? Of course. What do we see? What you earn, you appreciate more than what you get for free. And what you create, you appreciate more than what you earn. So in order for the world to come to be totally appreciated, to be the ultimate good, not only do you have to earn it, you have to create it. And that's what we do in this world. It's not just mitzvahs. It's everything in life. A person can do it in a way that is more godlike or less godlike. How do you know what's godlike and what's not godlike? The Torah gives you a guide. That's what we have mitzvahs for. They are a guide to what kinds of things in life are like God and what things are not like God. How do you eat in a godly way? How do you conduct your married life in a godly way? Your social life, your recreational life can all be done in a way that's more like God, and then your neshama becomes more like God and can bond with Him in a more intimate and intense way, or less like God, and you can bond with Him in a less intimate and less intense way. That's what this world is, a place where you can create eternity, an eternal bond with God. You make your neshama either more like God or less like God in the things that you do in this world, and that's what you create, that bond with God, eternally. That's what this world is all about. And to give you an example, what that means, what does it mean to live a godly life? We're not talking over here about going to shul and shaking and davening and whatever and eating matzah. That's part of it. But that's not even the major part. Major part can be explained the following way. There was a man, his name was, I think he's no longer alive, his name was Feuerstein. I don't remember his first name. A famous Boston mishpacha, but this was, he was a an owner of a textile mill outside of Boston. This happened a few years ago. He employed hundreds of workers, most of them not Jewish. And he had a very thriving textile business. And one day, a fire hit his textile mill and destroyed it, burnt it to the ground. He had no more business. He had hundreds of workers who were out of work. Morally, he could have told his workers, look, I don't have a business anymore. I really feel bad for you. I hope you'll find other jobs. If I ever build my business back, please come and I'd be happy to offer you jobs again. But at this point, I don't have a business and you don't have any jobs. But he didn't do that. He kept them on the payroll so they didn't lose their medical expenses, their medical benefits, nor their pensions. He even paid their salaries for a few months until they could reorganize themselves and find other jobs. And he told them, look, I don't have a job for you now. I'm going to keep you on the payroll vis-a-vis your medical benefits and your pensions. You go find other jobs. If you ever want to come back, if I build back my business, you have first rights to jobs here. That is acting in a godly way. Morally, could have washed his hands from all of them. But that's what it means to be, to act in your financial, in your economic life in a godly way. And it was picked up by every media, radio, television, magazines, newspapers, reported this, an observant Jew, this is something godly. That's what it means to function in every way, in a way that makes your neshama more godlike or less godlike. So we don't only earn our share in the world to come, we create it in everything we do. That's what it says, Bechol drachecho do'ehu. In everything you can get to know God. Knowing, knowledge over here means to be intimate, to have a connection to God. In everything you do. The Torah is a guide, and that guide guides you in everything, every part of life. And that is the purpose why we're put in this world, to create that eternity. Now, in that respect, the Gemara says the following. There was once a sinner who, in the midst of a sin, something happened that made an impression on him, an intense impression, and he repented and changed his lifestyle in a second, in a most intense way, so intense that he died right after that. And a bas kol went out and said, Ashrecha Reb Elazar ben Dordoi shemezumen lolam haba. A heavenly voice resounded that said that he earned his share in the world to come in that 1 second. So Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, the compiler of the Mishnah, when he heard this story, cried. And he said, Yeshkona olamo b'sha achas. It's possible for a person to acquire his world to come in 1 second. So the Telzer Rosh Yeshiva asks, what was he crying about? Should be elated. Wow, you can get your olam haba in 1 second. What's the cry about? He said he realized then that you could do it every second. And how many seconds do we let slip through our fingers and we don't create anything? You can create eternity every second. There's not just one world to come. There's an infinite, eternal amount of worlds to come. If you don't think that's possible, in mathematics, there's an infinite amount of whole numbers. But there's also an infinite amount of fractions between every whole number. So in mathematics, there's an infinite amount of infinities. If it works by mathematics, it can work by the world to come too. There's an infinite amount of eternities. There's no limit. And therefore, a person can acquire and create eternity every second in this world. And every second more and more and more. So there's no limit to it. And if you don't do anything for that second, you're losing eternity. Something to cry about. In that respect, last week I told you the secular view of life, which is basically you're born, eventually you die, fill up the time in between with things that make you feel good. Now, things that make you feel good can be very refined things. Opera, culture, helping other people is also very good. But it's basically what makes me feel good. That is the purpose. It's contrived, right? I know what makes me feel fulfilled, what makes me feel good, whether it's munching on a turkey leg and drinking beer, or it's helping other people and joining the Peace Corps. Obviously, joining the Peace Corps and helping other people is a lot better, and you'll be rewarded a lot stronger than drinking the beer and eating the turkey leg. But Lamaisa, it all boils down to the same thing. I'm born, I'm going to die. I really have to enjoy myself in this world and feel fulfilled, feel that I'm accomplishing, or whatever. If that's what life is all about, then no second of life is intrinsically important. Because you can't get pleasure in 1 second. Nothing in a second. Zero. So in order for life to be important from a secular standpoint, you need quantity and also quality of life. If you're 119 and a half, right, you don't have too much quantity left, so your life is not all that important. If you're 20, but you're in a coma in a hospital, then the quality of life is almost zero. So you may have plenty of quantity left, but your quality is nothing. How much enjoyment can you get in a coma? What can you do? Can't eat a steak, can't watch a movie, what can you do anyway? So your quality of life is almost zero, so your life is not intrinsically valuable. And that's why they're very easy to pull the plug on such a life. What kind of life is that? But from a Torah standpoint, every second of life on any level, you're in a coma and you're 119 and a half. What's your life worth? Eternity. Because 1 second of life, you're still alive. What can you do? Think. And even if the EEG shows flat brain waves, that doesn't mean you're not thinking. That means either the machine isn't sensitive enough to pick it up, and in 20 years they'll make a more sensitive machine, and then they'll apologize for pulling the plug. Or, no machine will ever pick up the brain waves, because there aren't. You're not thinking through your brain. You're still alive, but your neshama, your soul is thinking. So big deal, so you're thinking. What can you do with thought? In 1 second, you can repent and change your entire life and gain eternity. In 1 second. You can do a mitzvah that you can do with thinking. Loving God, fearing God. Other mitzvahs have to do totally with thought. In 1 second, you can think. And gain eternity. You can do all the mitzvahs, because if you want to do a mitzvah and you're prevented from doing it physically, you get rewarded as if you did it. So a person in that matzah can do all mitzvahs. Yes?
Are you within the realm of
the
Kriya?
A what?
Are you within the realm of the Kriya?
Yeah. Because as long as your neshama is still in your body, you haven't died, your neshama can think, and your neshama can think one way or the other, since it's in this world. Given free choice, right? You can't all you can't do is access and express that thought in a physical way. No, you can think, you can be kofar b'ikr, you can be an atheist, you can curse God in your mind. It definitely counts as an avera. Yeah, you can be over avodah zara. Right? There are plenty of things you can do just with thought, good and bad. Okay. In any case, so therefore, if I were to ask you, who values this world more? A person who's religious, who believes in a world to come, or a person who's secular and does not believe in a world to come? On the surface, you would say it's definitely the person who is secular who values this world more, because he doesn't have anything more. But we have a world to come, eternity, so this world's not so important. It's not true. From a secular standpoint, there is no intrinsic value to this world. It's only a value that comes from quantity and quality. But from a Torah standpoint, every second of this world is eternally important. So we value this world even more than the secular world values it, because this is the world where you create eternity. And that is the answer to what we asked last week, at least partially. One Mishnah says that this world is nothing compared to the world to come. It's totally unimportant. And the other Mishnah says that this world is greater than the world to come. It depends on your philosophy. If you look at this world as an end in itself, a place for enjoyment, the enjoyment of the world to come is infinitely greater. This world is nothing. But if you look at this world as a place to create that eternity, then it's better than the world to come. Because in the world to come, you have what you have and you're stuck with it. And here, you can create more every second. So that answers that. And now I'm going to explain that medrash that we said. The medrash said there were two criminals who were partners in crime. Remember the medrash? Okay. And one of them went to Gehenna and suffering there for his crimes. And the other one, he sees one day they're escorting him into Gan Eden, into heaven. So he asks, what's going on? And they tell him, you don't know, after you died, your partner saw how you were treated as such a despicable person. Nobody even wanted to bury you. So your partner repented. And he lived the end of his life a totally repentant, righteous man. So he's in heaven and you're in Gehenna. So the guy said, that's great. I'll repent too. So he said, just tell me what to say. I regret it. Get me out of here. The angel says, I'm sorry, but it's a little late. Didn't you know the world you came from is like Erev Shabbos, like Friday, and the world you're in now is like Shabbos? If you prepare on Friday, you could eat on Shabbos. If you didn't prepare, you woke up Friday night, now you can't cook. Too late to prepare now. You should have prepared Friday. You should have prepared when you were in the other world. You can't prepare in this world. And don't you know, the angel said, the world you came from is like the dry land, and the world you're in now is like the sea. If you supply your boat on the dry land, you have what to eat in the middle of the ocean. But you set sail with an empty boat. Now you're in the middle of the ocean, you want to eat. There's no supermarkets here. There's no restaurants here. It's too late. You should have supplied your boat before you left. And don't you know, the angel said, the world you came from is like the city, and the world you're in now is like the desert. If you prepare yourself in the city, you can survive in the desert. But you can't get the survival kit in the desert. You went into the desert empty-handed. Now it's too late. So you can't repent here over here. You should have repented before you came. So we asked two questions, and we'll answer them now. First question was, why didn't the angel tell this person another analogy? The analogy that it says in Pirkei Avos, that this world is like a preparation room to a castle. Prepare yourself in the preparation room so you should be able to go into the castle. Why didn't he say, you didn't prepare yourself in the preparation room, you can't go into the castle? Why did he tell him three other analogies and not the one that has the source in Pirkei Avos? And secondly, I'm sure the guy got the message after the first analogy. Why do you have to tell him three analogies? The answer is the following. The real analogy between this world and the next world is what it says in Pirkei Avos. This world is a preparation room to a castle. If you prepare yourself, you can get into the castle. What is that analogy, let's analyze it. It comes to tell me that there is no other purpose why this world was created, this physical world, than to prepare to go to the world to come. You don't build a preparation room to a castle for any other purpose than to prepare to go in the castle. That's what they made it for. You don't equip it with anything else. It's only equipped with things that will prepare you to go to the castle. Hair dryers, cosmetics, whatever else, brushes, whatever you need to prepare. Dressing rooms. And you don't use it for any other purpose. It doesn't have ping pong tables there, and you don't use it for simchas. You use it for one purpose, prepare to go to the castle. This world was created for no other purpose. God didn't create this world, this physical world, for any other purpose than to give us the opportunity to create Olam Haba. And that's all we're supposed to do here, and that's all it's equipped for. Every single thing in the world, animal, vegetable, mineral, beautiful sunsets and sunrises are there because somehow you can use them to get closer to God and to make your neshama more godlike and to create your eternity. Every single thing in the world, some kind of bug in the Amazon, was created because somehow it affects something else that affects something else that people need to be able to use this world properly. There's no other purpose. And that doesn't mean you sit and say tillim all day preparing for the world to come. It means that every aspect of life, social life, married life, economic life, political life, everything can be done in a way that makes your soul more godlike or less godlike. And that's the sole purpose, no pun intended, of this world. But that is the real perspective, the real hashkafa. Go tell a wicked person who lived his whole life in terrible crime, didn't you know the whole purpose of this world was to prepare for the world to come? Of course he didn't know that. And he doesn't know it now either, because when you die, you don't become a big philosopher and a righteous person. You become dead. That's it. And we might remain with the same ideas you had before. So the Malach did not waste his breath. The angel didn't waste his breath in telling this person what the real, didn't you know that the whole purpose of this world that you came from was to prepare for the next world? He didn't know that. But he said to him, maybe you understood that this world was like Erev Shabbos and the next world is like Shabbos. A different analogy. Completely different. The purpose of Friday is not totally for Shabbos. You eat breakfast Friday. You go to work on Friday. The majority of Friday is preparing for Shabbos. Maybe that you understood. This world's a nice place too. But you should have at least spent most of the time preparing for the world to come. You should have had that in mind. Like Friday to Shabbos. You didn't. And even if that you didn't understand, the angel said. And in your mind, this world and the next world were equally important, like the dry land and the sea. But you knew that one day your boat's going to sail. You're not going to be here forever. You're going to have to go into that sea. Why didn't you supply your boat? Why'd you set sail with an empty boat? And even if that you didn't understand, and in your mind, this world was the city, the main thing, and the next world was a desert to you, desolate, meaningless. But you knew one day everybody goes into that desert. Why didn't you at least get a survival kit? Why didn't you prepare something? Nothing. So either you didn't believe there's another world, or you didn't care. Either way, you don't deserve to get into it. That's what the angel told him. No matter what you thought, but the real hashkafa is what it says in Pirkei Avos. Mirtz Hashem, next week we will continue and get then to, based on this, right, the questions we asked about why Yaakov Avinu couldn't take it easy in this world, and why nobody can take it easy, and then eventually we'll get to what Simcha is. I